The following program may contain material that is unsuitable for some audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Aftermath Radio should not be considered a substitute for services provided by a licensed mental health professional. Good afternoon and welcome to Aftermath Radio, brought to you live from the K-Beach radio station at Cal State Long Beach.
Gigi Bar.
Can you hear me now?
Very good. Is everyone else here? Yeah?
Here.
Chant? Good? All right, we'll get to our special guest in a minute. Can you hear yourself? Yeah? Okay, great. Aftermath Radio, Dr. Robert Shug, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State, where we talk about all things psychopathic. If you'd like to speak with us, the phone number is area code 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. You can Skype that girl over there, Chantal Fahmy, at aftermath.radio. You can email me at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. And as always, we encourage you to visit the website aftermathradio.org, click on the link in the lower left-hand corner of the screen, and all the podcasts are there archived for your listening pleasure. This is the very special law enforcement edition of Aftermath Radio. No, come on, don't laugh on that.
Sorry, seriously.
Try it again. The very special law enforcement edition of Aftermath Radio. We have two really cool guests today. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we have Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole, retired FBI special agent, criminal profiler, going to be talking about criminal profiling and psychopathy. But first, I'm equally as excited to have investigator Damon Tucker from the Orange County District Attorney's Office, who is also adjunct professor of criminal justice here in our very own Department of Criminal Justice. And Professor Tucker, investigator Tucker, I'm not sure how to refer to you.
Damon's fine.
Damon, very good. And so, actually, this all transpired with me cornering Damon in the copy room. And I know that he has a very interesting career, and a lot of the work that he does is very relevant to understanding how psychopathy kind of manifests criminally in terms of fraud and other sorts of crimes. And he agreed to come in and kind of talk about some of the work that he's doing.
No problem. I'm good. Let's go.
And so Damon, I guess tell everyone a little bit about kind of who you are and your background, and then we'll kind of lead into some of the work you've been doing lately.
For my background in education, I'm a graduate here from Cal State Long Beach. I got my undergrad here back in the early 90s in criminal justice, and then I returned about 10 years later and got my master's degree also in criminal justice. And I've been teaching here off and on for about a little over 6 years, I think. And then as far as law enforcement experience, while I was here as an undergrad, I did my internship with the Department of Treasury as a U.S. Customs clerk. And then after graduating, I worked for the Department of Defense at Terminal Island in Long Beach as a federal police officer. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I went to the Los Angeles Unified School District Police Department. And then did that for a few years, then went to Irvine Police Department for about 7 or 8 years, and then I've been with the District Attorney's Office of Orange County for a little over 8 years now.
It's impressive. So this guy's no slouch.
Yeah. I'm slouching right now.
Right. He is slouching, actually. So now, a lot of the work that Damon does in terms of, well, maybe I should let you tell me and everybody else, what does an investigator for the District Attorney's Office do? What's their sort of function?
It's similar to a traditional investigator at a police department, and then the word investigator and detective are kind of the same word. It just depends on the agency on what the designation would be. But at a police department, a victim reports a crime or the police discover a crime, and the investigator attempts to identify the offender, the responsible parties, put together a case, and prepare it for submission to the district attorney's office. After they've completed their investigation and submitted to the district attorney's office, the DA's office employs investigators as well. And we are similar to the police department investigators in that we do the same sort of tasks, except that at this point the case is actually filed by the DA or is about to be filed by the DA. And we might do things to fill in the blanks. There might be additional follow-up work that might be beyond the ability or the resources of the local police agency, particularly a smaller agency. It might be something more for trial preparation where the investigator of the police department doesn't really deal with the victims as much as we do after the case has been filed. We track victims down, witnesses, make sure they show up to court. And then we also assist during the prosecution, either at a preliminary hearing or at a jury trial.
And so typically what sort of crimes would you be investigating then?
Well, since the DA's office, we have a variety of assignments depending on what you would like to work or what your expertise might be. My background is in fraud. So working for the DA's office, I worked what they call a felony panel, which is a generic catch-all type of crimes, your typical robberies, burglaries, auto thefts, domestic violence, that type of thing. The more serious crimes go to what they call vertical units, which are units like the gang unit. We have a target unit, which focuses on specific gangs that are a public nuisance. We have a homicide unit. We have a sexual assault unit, consumer fraud and insurance fraud, workers' compensation fraud, major fraud, environmental crime, family protection. You've got a variety of assignments. So since I've been with the DA, I've worked in the vertical assignment as a major fraud investigator. And then for the past 3 years, I've been in the sexual assault unit, with the last year and a half or so working the sexually violent predator caseload.
Wow, that's fantastic. And then in terms, I think, of just right off the bat, what we're allowed to talk about today is a little limited. So and yes. you might be steering us away from topics, and that's not because you're rude. It's just because we have to be careful.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Why do you have more bass in your voice than I do?
I think it's because I was born with a very bassy voice.
Just checking.
Plus, I make Gigi turn up the bass on my channel. Right.
I think you guys are both even right now.
So it doesn't sound.
I could take some helium if you want.
Yeah.
All right. So, and you and I, we've conversed in the past from time to time about folks that you've run across in terms of the cases you're working in. And a lot, there seems to be a lot of overlap, I notice, between the folks that I've worked with, in research and whatnot, and talking about sort of psychopathic traits being the focus of the show. I also wanted to reiterate that we're not going to be diagnosing anybody today that either Damon or I talk about as a psychopath. We have to be very clear about that. We can speculate, or at least I can speculate, that the traits might be consistent with traits we've seen in other psychopathic individuals, but by all means, we are not putting that label on anybody. Just to clarify.
That would be correct.
Right? Okay. All right. So in terms of cases then, and you've handed me a couple of press releases here, and all these are actually very fascinating, and I wanted to get this one in before the break. This first one, can I say what city it's out of? Or
you can, anything is in the
anything on here is fair game? Great. Okay, so
these cases are they've already resolved. They've either pled guilty, been found guilty.
Some of this stuff reads like a crime novel, to be quite honest with you. It's like
pretty interesting.
Truth is what is it? Truth's more interesting than fiction? There's a better way to say that. Yep. I just didn't do it here. Okay, so Santa Ana, financial planner, sentenced to 18 years in state prison for stealing approximately $2.8 million from vulnerable elderly people, many of whom he met through his father's church. Should I say his name? I guess it's fair game. But Hitomi Tsuyuki, age 57, from Koto de Kasa, pleaded guilty September 30th. 2011 to 17 felony counts of the use of untrue statements in the sale of his security, 10 felony counts of theft from an elder, 1 felony count of grand theft, 1 felony count of the use of his scheme to defraud, and a sentencing enhancement for causing property damage over $2.5 million. So this guy sounds like a real piece of work. My opinion, not yours.
That's right, yes.
What can you say anything about this particular case in generalities, of course?
Couple of interesting things about it. The psychological end for the victims on this case is that for fraud cases as well as sexual assault and a few other cases, there's the dark figure of crime that we hear about in our criminological theory classes.
Right.
And that's typically the crime that is not observed or reported or discovered by law enforcement. And a sexual assault victim may be reluctant to report a crime because of it might be their word against that of the defendants. There might be issues of embarrassment or reliving it in court, so you might have an underreporting for sexual assault. Fraud crimes typically have that sort of effect as well, where there's a dark figure in that you may not report the crime because sometimes you may not even know you're a victim. That might be one. But also, if you are a victim, that you might feel that you fell for it. You fell for a scam. You fell for something. In the Tsuyuki case, this was more of what we call an affinity fraud. Affinity is where the suspect has a something in common with the victim to maybe make them lower their guard a little bit. It could be things like race, ethnicity. It could be, you know, what you do for a living. It could be religion. It could be a variety of things. And as you might see in the press release, Mr. Tsuyuki's victims, some of them came from a church.
Right.
And you had some ethnic affinity going on in this case, as well as religion, where the victims were either maybe of the same ethnicity or attended the church where his father was the pastor.
And so how willing are these people then to come forward when they realize they're victimized?
It's not that they're reluctant. It's maybe the disbelief initially talking to some of them that they are victims. Maybe they didn't even know it when I contacted them. Might be an embarrassment thing that they
right.
trusted them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not speaking necessarily to these victims. It could be any victim on a major fraud type case. Getting the phone call from me that, you know, hey, I went through this guy's bank records and found your name in this cash check. You know, did you realize that your money didn't go where you intended it to? And that sometimes is a very shocking thing for the victims.
Some of these victim statements are incredible. I mean, there's people here talking about this guy stealing a third of their retirement. Another person investing $20,000 in a couple of different installments. So this guy was really he was getting a lot of money, and he was victimizing a very vulnerable population. And I think, like you said, with that, in terms of affinity, in terms of ethnicity and perhaps age, I don't know, but people perhaps more willing to give of themselves and then open themselves up to something like this.
That's true.
And we talk about, in psychology anyway, we talk about conning and manipulative behavior that psychopaths can be characterized by. And I'm not calling Mr. Tsuyuki a psychopath by any means, but this sort of conning and manipulative behavior looks like a pattern over many victims. I'm imagining over a fair bit of time, you know, might suggest sort of that personality characteristic in him. But again, my words, not Damon's. anything else particularly interesting about this guy?
Without giving content of my interview with him, I can tell you that at least he was very very convincing to me when speaking with him, giving explanations for his behavior or what evidence I might have confronted him with. And me being cynical for what I do and the amount of cases I've done over the years, to sit in front of somebody that the evidence that I've seen and possessed indicates that they've done something criminally in a violation of a law, possibly, to have them be almost smooth enough to convince me that they've done no wrong tells me that the victims are sometimes unarmed going against a guy like this, because you just don't see it coming. These guys that do these things are very, very smooth, very articulate, very unassuming, very confident in talking and presenting the scam that they might be presenting.
Right. Actually, I'd like to ask you a few more questions about that. We got to go to a break, though.
Sure.
So we'll be right back after this, Aftermath Radio, here on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shug Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
We're back, Aftermath Radio. Dr. Robert Shug, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State. You can reach us at 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. You can chat with Chant over there on Skype at aftermath.radio. How are we doing so far?
The chat.
Oh.
There we go.
Probably a good thing.
A few of our friends are online, but no one's chatting.
No, they're just kind of like circling.
Yeah.
Like vultures.
I mean, is it annoying if I chat them?
No, I think that's outreach, right? Oh, we got to pimp the Twitter too, right?
Oh,
do you have the Twitter sound effect hooked up?
Yes, I do.
All right, so how do they tweet us? Or we tweet them, right?
No.
I'm so confused. I'm so technologically lame.
We tweet out, so whoever's...
There we go. So you tweeted today about Damon and Dr. O'Toole, right?
G did.
Yes, I did.
And I'm
good.
Tweeting now.
Okay,
and
good.
I did last week.
Get the word out, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so Damon Tucker, investigator from the Orange County District Attorney's Office, talking about fraud cases, and I'm sort of trying to relate it back to psychopathic traits. And we've been talking about a case here, well, not here in Orange County, but right over there in Orange County, right, of Hitomi Tsuyuki?
Tsuyuki,
right. Yeah. And 18 years in prison for a whole bunch of counts of fraud. Now, when we were in the commercial break, you and I were sort of talking about the way these fraudsters, is that the right word, fraudster? Or
it's a good.
People who perpetrate fraud?
Yep, fraudster's good.
Yeah. Chantal's giving me that look, like the crunchy nose look.
Why does that sound?
Fraudster sounds kind of lame.
It doesn't sound like a real word.
No, it doesn't.
I get it. It is.
Yeah, fraudster is very. Yeah, it's a compliment.
It sounds like an old 1930s gangster. Yeah, ah, fraudster, right? But anyway, the way these folks present to you, because you talk to a lot of these people.
Yes.
And they probably try to get one over on you, just like they try to get one over on just about everyone.
Yes, they do.
And so, what can you say in generalities, of course, about what you tend to see from these folks when you're sitting in front of them?
For the fraud suspects, they tend to talk to me, and even when they might know the target of an investigation, they have an explanation. If I confront them with documents or evidence or witnesses' statements or victim statements, they have an explanation. Sometimes they rationalize what they've done. And we talked a little bit on the break about a term that I used in the past with you, which was Eddie Haskell,
mm-hmm.
and that's from the Leave It to Beaver show. And it's a term that I'd say applies to a lot of crooks I've interviewed over the years. And even if it's a burglar, car thief, you know, your typical shoplifter, there's the Eddie Haskell, which is, you know, gee, Mrs. Cleaver, I didn't mean to break your window. You know, gee, I didn't mean to steal that, or I didn't mean to mismanage the money that was entrusted to me by the particular victim. So they kind of have this, maybe I did it, but I didn't really mean to do it. So there's that might remove their intent or their specific intent.
Right. Sort of like almost an accident.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for fraud cases, most of fraud cases are specific intent crimes. So if I give you, a large sum of money to invest for me and you use it to pay for your cars and for your home and vacations and you don't invest it, then you used it for something that it wasn't intended to do. So I have to prove that in court through your bank records and statements and things that you've done. But it's the fraud element is, did you intend to use that for the ill-gotten purposes or did you just mismanage the money? And so we follow the money around quite a bit to show what they really did with it. But their defense sometimes is, I took the money in and I never intended to misuse it. But because my bills came in, I figured I'll use this money that was entrusted to me for investment.
So on my end of things, we might look at that as sort of a lack of remorse or a failure to accept responsibility for one's actions, again, which may or may not be considered psychopathic, in the particular cases you have seen. But if you see patterns of these behaviors over and over again, that's probably what the case is. Okay, so we have Delicia Holt, 48. So this is this, again, reads like a novel, right? A former congressional candidate was sentenced today to pay over $40,000 in restitution for defrauding Orange County hotels and stealing a Mercedes-Benz from a local car dealership. Delicia Holt, 48, Eliseo Viejo, was found guilty by a jury December 22, 2009, of 7 felony counts of writing non-sufficient fund checks. I can totally hear you, Gigi, by the way. 1 felony count each of grand theft and defrauding an innkeeper by non-payment, in addition to paying over $40,000 in restitution. Okay, so she tell me about Ms. Holt, then.
Delicia Holt came to our attention based on a rather lengthy investigative article done by the Orange County Register. They somehow were researching political candidates, and she ran for Congress for a spot in San Diego, which was a spot that belonged formerly to Randall Duke Cunningham, who is currently in prison for a variety of of crimes down in San Diego.
Famous name.
And so she ran for his spot, and then somehow this expose came about, and the investigative reporter uncovered some potentially fraud issues, and our office investigated it. I investigated it. And during the course of it, I was able to put a case together. She was charged, and she did not plead guilty. She went to trial in front of a jury of our peers and was found guilty of the counts that you mentioned there. She was a fascinating person to investigate and to interview. in that the interview that I did with her without giving content lasted, I think, 5 hours.
Wow.
And, you know, it was, again, a lot of rationalizing type behavior, very convincing to me that, you know, she obviously probably doesn't think what she's done is wrong, and had an explanation for a lot of the things that I asked her about. During the trial, which she took the stand on the trial, and during that, I think the only thing I really noted about her behavior in the courtroom was that I believe she used to she was addressing the prosecutor by his first name, and you know, it seemed, you know, for the formality of a courtroom, you know, for the public being in there, seeing somebody not referring to the prosecutor as either Mr. Prosecutor or by his, you know, his last name, and just referring to him as a first name was kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, one thing we often see in the literature on psychopathy is sort of narcissism, grandiosity, and it sounds like something like that, you know, taking the other person down a peg or two really might speak to that. Do you get a lot of that kind of narcissism vibe when you're talking to these people?
Yes, I do. Yes.
You want to think about that one first?
Yeah, that took me a second.
How do you deal with that? Because I know for me in my work, it can be difficult.
For the vast majority, when I do interviews or interrogations, I tend to let them run with that. I want them to think they're smarter than me. Mm-hmm. They know more than I do. I'm not from California. I used to be from a southern part of the country, and so I will sometimes slip into a bit of a southern accent to make them even feel more comfortable that I'm some rube out of the, you know, out of the sticks, and I don't understand computers or finance or whatever it is. And they will talk sometimes to educate me about what they think I don't know.
Right.
So it's pretty interesting.
In psychology, we call that the Columbo technique.
Yeah, and,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of detectives over the years. I've learned to use that technique from more senior detectives.
Right, right.
It's very effective, though.
That's fascinating. Let me think. So we're right up against the commercial here. Anything else that you wanted to say, I think, in terms of, you know, we really didn't get a chance to talk about SVPs at all, which was one thing we kind of wanted to. Maybe we can have you come back and talk about that in another show.
Sure.
But in terms of fraud, I mean, any other sort of thoughts you might have or things you might have noticed over the years in working with these types of individuals?
No, I mean, other than they're prepared for, most of the times for me to knock on your door at some point. If at some point they do get caught, there's probably an explanation for it, but you know, it's not an impulse type crime that I'm seeing a lot of these people doing. They're preparing for, you know, if I get caught, you know, is there going to be evidence on my computers? You know, am I going to have an explanation for where their money went? Are they going to conceal their identity or the flow of money in and out of their accounts? So it's the preparation in doing these crimes is not impulsive. They you know, they're rational people. They are thinking this stuff out, and they're doing the best way they can to put hurdles up to insulate themselves from their victims as well as from law enforcement.
And by the time you get to them, when you're sitting in front of them, is it pretty much a done deal in terms of the amount of evidence that's already there, or is that just on a case-by-case basis? It depends.
Case-by-case. Usually once a suspect's been identified from like a victim reporting or something, and I go out and interview them, I want to get their side of the story first because maybe it might be a civil issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we investigate to determine whether or not there's a crime in the first place. And then we interview them, see what their mindset is, their intent. If it's explainable, it's civil, then it's handled by a different venue. If it's criminal, then it might take me months to a year or so to go through their financials to get enough evidence to come back to contradict what they told me during that initial interview.
Right. Well, it's fascinating stuff, Damon. Really, thank you so much for coming by. And you're going to hang out for the rest of the show with us, too, right?
Sure.
Okay, great. And coming up after the break, we have retired FBI criminal profiler Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole. We'll be right back here on Aftermath Radio on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shugg Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
We're back, Aftermath Radio. Dr. Robert Shugg, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Psychology here at Long Beach State. Please do call us at 562-912-3541. That's 562-912-3541. Skype us at aftermath.radio. Email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. This is our special law enforcement episode of Aftermath Radio. There you go. We're actually very, very excited to have our next guest on. This is Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole, who's a retired FBI special agent who spent nearly 15 years as a criminal profiler in the FBI's Elite Behavioral Analysis Unit. She's a fellow with the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and author of the book Dangerous Instincts, How Gut Feelings Betray Us. Mary Ellen, are you there?
I am here.
Great. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us tonight. And we can call you Mary Ellen, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And tonight, we're going to be talking about criminal profiling.
Okay.
And how it relates to psychopathic traits. And I'm actually just scrambling here for my questions. Here we are. And so I'll just jump right into it there, Mary Ellen. So in your research at the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, do you study psychopathy in crime scenes? And what led you to conducting research in this specific area?
I did study psychopathy in crime scenes. And when I was in the unit, towards the end of my career, I was assigned to simply look at serial murder cases and work on those cases. And when I looked at them, I thought, well, wait a minute. There are many serial killers who are out there, but their crime scenes are very different, and yet they all seem to have traits of psychopathy. What would account for the distinction in these offenders in terms of how they got their victims, what they did to the victims? So I started to really pull back the behaviors in these cases and take a look at them individually, and I realized that it was that while all these offenders very likely had the traits of psychopathy, it was the amount or the dose of psychopathy in each individual trait that made a difference.
And just you've worked on some very high profile cases too. Yeah. I think we should let everyone know. Can you just name a couple of the ones you've worked on?
Sure, I worked on the Gary Ridgway case, and Gary is called the Green River Killer. I worked on the Unabomber case involving Ted Kaczynski. I worked on the Derek Todd Lee case down in Louisiana, and the Sean Gillis case also down in Louisiana. Did a little bit of work on the Zodiac case out in San Francisco, and that case still has not been resolved. And then some probably less high-profile cases that were serial. There were two major ones in Los Angeles, and one was the Grim Reaper.
Right.
And he recently was sent to prison, and I worked on that one as well.
It's quite a resume.
Oh. Scary one.
A scary resume, right. So why is it important to know if a crime was committed by a psychopath?
Well, it's so important because it will make a difference in terms of the investigative strategy that you want to design. And it makes a difference also in terms of the interview strategy that you want to utilize if you have the opportunity to interview the person. And then finally, it makes a difference just in terms of prosecutors and how they want to present that information to a jury of just regular people who may see this person walk into court and say, wow, he's wearing a beautiful three-piece suit. He couldn't possibly have done what they've accused him of doing. And they need to understand what psychopathy is and what it allows somebody to do in a serial murder case.
Right. Now, is it likely that a psychopath's crime scenes are different in a behavioral sense than crimes committed by a non-psychopath?
Yes, I think that they are. That's my sense of it after having done this for so many years, that a psychopath's behavior at a crime scene will appear to be different from a non-psychopathic individual.
Okay, and what is it about their personality that distinguishes them from other offenders?
Well, if you look at, or if you know what the 20 traits of psychopathy are, and they're broken down into four categories, some of the traits really do resonate in a crime scene. And I'll just give you an example. One of the traits that of psychopathy that we know is really almost the foundation of this disorder is that these individuals have no guilt or remorse for what they do. So if you look at that trait and say, okay, what does that look like at a crime scene? How does someone who commits a series of homicides, how do they demonstrate that they lack remorse or guilt for what they do? And here are a couple of examples of how that can happen. They can continue to kill over and over again, and they can actually get better at it. So one time they may have made some mistakes. The next time they fix those mistakes. And the third, fourth, 10th, 20th time, they actually take effort. serious effort to not be apprehended so that they can get away with the homicides. So when you look at that, you have to say, is this person who knows right from wrong, he's not out of touch with reality, this is somebody who wants to get away with murder. So when you see a series like that, that to me suggests someone without empathy or remorse. And then another way is how the killer leaves the body. If the body is left in a very degrading way to the victim, or the body is left in this circumstance where it's unlikely they will ever be found and reunited for proper burial with their family, again, that suggests someone who doesn't care about the victim, nor do they care about the victim's family.
Do you feel that all psychopaths are alike, or in your work?
No, I don't feel that they're all alike. And having interviewed a lot of these psychopathic people and worked on hundreds and hundreds of serial murder cases, I know that they're not alike. They're different. But the premise for their difference, after many years of thinking about it and, of course, consulting with Dr. Robert Hare, who's I think we all know is considered one of the, if not the world's expert in psychopathy, is what would, what is the reason for this distinction? And so we began to break it down trait by trait, and that seemed to be the key.
Now, other traits like glib and superficial charm are also included within psychopathy. What are some ways that these traits could manifest at a scene? Because this is really more sort of like an interpersonal thing.
Yes, it is an interpersonal thing, and I would combine grandiosity with glib and charming. And one of the things that I look for is the way the individual approaches the victim, and the way I know that is not to be too, insensitive to the victims, but I look at defensive injuries to the victims, and that I get from the medical examiner's report. Mm-hmm. So if the victims show an absence of defensive injuries, in other words, injuries to their hands, to their wrists, to other parts of their body that they would normally use as weapons to fight off an attacker. If there's an absence of those kinds of injuries, which I've had in a number of cases, I always have to ask myself, how did this victim let this offender get that close? What was it that made that victim feel like he or she could let their guard down and let that offender into their comfort zone? So it's the absence of behavior sometimes that tells me, wait a minute, if he was able to get that close to someone and not send off red flags that he's dangerous, this has to be somebody that, at least I had to consider, somebody who was very glib and charming.
Right.
And certainly that would be one way. And then for the grandiosity, I would look at aspects of the case that would tell me, how did this person even come up to the victim and assume that they could access the victim? So, like, for example, in the case of Theodore Robert Bundy, who was a poster child for serial murder back in the late 1970s, he was going up to young women in college who were raised in middle-class homes, who were told, don't go with strangers, don't let your guard down. And yet Bundy was able to approach them and use what we call a ruse, R-U-S-E.
Mm-hmm.
And a ruse is making up a story that you need help. And in his case, what he did was he would bandage his arm, and it would make the young woman feel like the arm was broken. Then he would go up. And he would do this in broad daylight, so there's a grandiose aspect to that. And
sure.
He would say, I need help. Can you help me put my boat on the top of my VW car? They would look at him and say, here's a young guy who's my age. He's injured. Of course I'm going to help him. So those kinds of aspects you can get from behavior at a crime scene.
Can you give us any other traits of psychopathy and how they might be sort of visible at a crime scene?
Sure. One of the ones that I look for, and is impulsivity. And
mm-hmm.
Impulsivity is to momentarily consider the consequences of the behavior you are about to engage in and then going ahead and doing it. And that's the definition within the psychopathic literature. So if it's a trait of psychopathy, someone like Gary Ridgway was an impulsive offender. But when you looked at Gary's crime scenes, he did them pretty much the same way over and over again. And he was able to successfully kill over about four decades. So he was actually pretty successful, but he didn't vary a great deal in how he would access the victims, where he would take them, and what he would do to them. So you compare and contrast that to someone else who has a high dose of impulsivity. That means that they're much quicker to react and spend less time thinking about it, less time planning it. So they may be looking for someone on a, as they're parked in their car along the street, and they see someone who's a redhead, 5 foot five, and they'll say, she'll do. Or the next time they go out, if they're highly impulsive, they may say, well, here's a 60-year-old woman with blonde hair. She's 5 foot ten. Well, she'll do. So when you see high degrees of impulsivity in serial murder cases, it's my opinion you will see a much greater variation in the age of the victim, the race of the victim, how the victim is killed, where the victim's body is left, how the victim's body is disposed of. So it's actually, the variation is actually one of the linkages.
Wow. That's fascinating stuff, Mary Ellen. We got to take a break right here. Can you hold on for one more segment?
Certainly.
Great. Okay, Aftermath Radio, we'll be right back after this here on K-Beach.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm a psychopath.
Hi, Bob!
Bob!
Do you know what a psychopath is? Do you have one in your life? How would you know? Join Dr. Robert Shug Mondays at 4 p.m. for Aftermath Radio and get the facts about psychopathy.
Well, we're back. Aftermath Radio, Dr. Robert Shug. We have on the line Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole, retired FBI special agent, spent nearly 15 years as a criminal profiler in the FBI's Elite Behavioral Analysis Unit. She has a book out, which actually we will mention, Mary Ellen, called Dangerous Instincts, How Gut Feelings Betray Us. And we're talking about criminal profiling and psychopathy and sort of the link between the two. And Mary Ellen has worked on a number of fascinating cases, and it sounds like she's certainly seen how some of these traits can manifest in crime scene behaviors. So, Mary Ellen, once you believe that your offender could be a psychopath, how does that change the investigative strategy?
Okay, good question. And it can change it in a number of ways, but let me just give you an example. We had a case up in the Northwest where an individual was targeting prostitutes, and this would have been in the 90s into 2000. And when the original folks were working the case, they were creating appeals to the offender through the media to do the right thing, that the family was hurting, and, you know, to come forward, to let, you know, to put some resolution on this case.
Right.
And those kinds of appeals don't work with a psychopath, because a psychopath doesn't have feelings for the victim, does not have remorse for what they do, and they're certainly not going to respond to that kind of appeal. So now we know when we have a case and it's unsolved, and if there are media reports on the crime, and we know that very often these people follow their crimes in the media, we want to be very careful about staying away from mentioning the victim, even though it's, I know to some people listening this, they'll say, well, it's all about the victim. And they're right, it is. But when you're dealing with a psychopath, you have to attend to their psychology. And they are not interested in talking about the victim or hearing about the victim. So you appeal to them. And you may suggest things like, for example, you may say, you know, what we want to do is to be able to understand your motivation for doing this. You've made mistakes. We have a lot of leads that are coming in. We have a lot of people that are providing us with information, because that undermines that sense that they committed the perfect crime. So that may be one thing. And, you know, again, I think that psychopaths are very grandiose in their thinking. So they do think that they've committed the perfect crime scene. And every once in a while, you'll have a case where you can generate a conversation between the serial killer and the investigator. You don't look to do that, because it can be very dangerous, but if it looks like they're the type of person, the psychopath is the type of psychopath that would be willing to engage in a conversation, whether it's through the newspaper or through email, that can be very helpful to the investigation as well.
How does it change your interview strategy once you've identified the offender then, knowing he's a psychopath?
Yeah, the interview strategy changes significantly. For example, during your first 5 minutes of the interview, as the interviewer, you want to be very careful about not letting that psychopathic person or the person you suspect is psychopathic think that you're nervous. So you have your game plan completely laid out, so you're not saying, okay, Robert, let's make sure we both have enough paper. Do you have coffee? Well, I've got coffee. Is your cell phone off? Yes, mine's off. Let's make sure we tell the captain what room we're in. Those are not things you want to do around a psychopath because they can imply uncertainty, nervousness, insecurity. So you want to have your game plan, and including the physical layout of the interview room, all laid out before you start the interview. And then secondly, people always think you build rapport with your interview suspect. And that's true if it's a non-psychopath. But if you're dealing with a psychopath, they don't bond with other people. So when you say things like, I have a son, you have children, I have a son your child's age, they're going to the same school, I think they're in the same Boy Scout group, that's rapport building. That does not work with a psychopath. You have to immediately make the interview all about them. And don't waste your time pre-planning rapport building. And there's one other thing I found to be extremely valuable. Because we know that psychopaths don't have the same kinds of emotions that you and I have, when you ask them about emotions, they have to make them up. And so that makes them very vulnerable in an interview. So what I like to do and what I teach when I'm teaching interviewing of psychopaths is to ask them about how they're feeling about the victims, because they know the right response is, I feel bad for what I did, but they don't really feel it. And so you gently push them to get them to explain, what does feeling bad feel like for you, Robert, if you're the psychopath? What does it feel like? And they'll have to make up an answer, just as though I ask you how it felt when you were pregnant. That's an experience you've never had. So you have to go with what you think that was like, and that can be a very frustrating and is very frustrating for them that they have to make it up, and you keep pushing them to have them give you that answer. So, but that can be very effective in an interview because it can cause them to feel uncertain and kind of rattled, and that's when you may get really good information about what happened.
Right. As usual, there's just so much to talk about with you and so little time. Just a couple minutes left. I did want to talk about the book, but you mentioned to me in the email David Parker Ray. Yeah. Can you spend maybe a minute or two talking about him and maybe how some of this sort of played out with him?
Sure. David Parker Ray, and you notice good serial killers always have three names.
Yeah.
David was the offender in a series of very, very extreme sexually sadistic homicides in New Mexico. He was 60 years old when we arrested him without really a significant, if any, criminal record. And he lived a lifestyle that made him appear very normal. When we arrested David, he had a torture chamber in his backyard, and he told investigators that it was all for fantasy. How we got on to him was one of the women he had arrested on a Friday night got away on a Monday morning. She was found wearing a dog collar walking down the streets of this small area in New Mexico. And when interviewed, she told police what had happened. She'd been kidnapped, brought back to his home, and tortured and kept against her will. So when they called me, I flew out there, and I went into his torture chamber. And it was an amazing experience to see what he had built and put together over a period of 40 years. So almost at the point where I finished going through the torture chamber, I was told he wanted to meet me. So I went to the county jail where he was being held. And there he came into the room where I was, and he was walking very slowly. His ankles were shackled, and his wrists were shackled as well. And I kept looking at him thinking, Mary Ellen, don't forget what you already know. He came across as one of the most humble, sweetest men that I've ever met. And he was very charming, very soft-spoken. And he said, oh, Mary Ellen, thank you so much for coming to see me. This was a county jail. But it was, I had to constantly, throughout that interview, tell myself, don't forget what you already know. That is his torture chamber. He is a sexual sadist, but you could see right away how women would easily have gone with him because he came across as so normal, so charming, and just so non-threatening.
That's a fantastic story, Mary Ellen. I know what we don't have much time left, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about your book. Can you tell us about it and where folks can get it?
Oh, thank you. The book is called Dangerous Instincts, How Gut Feelings Betray Us. And the basis for the book was I wanted to help other people really understand how to read behavior and not rely on this nebulous, magical entity in the middle of their stomachs that we oftentimes will say, well, that's I relied on my gut to go with this person, to trust this person, to get into the car, go out on a date. And yet, again, it's this entity in our stomachs that we have, and we don't know how to train it, educate it, know when it's having a good day or a bad day. But I cannot tell you how many times over my 32 years in law enforcement where I've heard people say, I went with my gut, and now look what happened. So what I wanted to do was give back to people and to be able to share with them how I would do personality assessments in the FBI and what I would look for and the behaviors I would look for and how to look for those behaviors. Once you know what to look for, then you can make better decisions whether you're meeting somebody online or you are hiring somebody to come in and do some work inside your home, or you're hiring a financial advisor. And when you have those skills, you don't have to rely on magical thinking. And I think the book, again, it's designed to really help people from men to women of all ages, because we all have everyday decisions to make about whether or not this person is safe and can we let them into our comfort zone. And you have to have some basis, some good skills, some tools to help you make those decisions.
It's a fascinating book, by the way, and I highly recommend it. And where can folks get it then, Mary Ellen?
They can get it on online. They can get it in bookstores if your bookstore is still open. They can get it on Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble.
Okay, and we still have like half an interview left. Would you be willing to come on again sometime in the future and maybe talk more about this?
I would love that.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. There you go. What do you guys think? You guys don't have headphones on, so you don't know. All right. We got to wrap it up here. So next week is the season finale of Aftermath Radio. We're going to do the Wheel of Controversy with Dr. Dave Kossin, Dr. Leanne Leadham, and Dr. Paul Babiak. Always
oldie but goodie.
Oldie but goodie. And we're going to say some parting words to our producers as well, who will be leaving us for bigger and better things, right? But we'll say that for next week. In the meantime, if you want to speak with us, you can leave us voicemails on our phone line, 562-912-3541, or email us at aftermathradio@kbeach.com. Skype us at aftermath.radio. Until next week, Chant, anything? Any parting words of wisdom? Or a blank stare?
Does our guest have any parting words of wisdom?
Damon Tucker, any parting words of wisdom?
I feel... like I was the opening act. I don't have a plug, though. And I need some serious therapy after this.
I'm not licensed, but I can probably do some damage.
That was very, very fascinating. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Damon. Okay, until next week, Aftermath Radio here on KBeach.
You've been listening to Aftermath Radio, production of the KBeach radio station at California State University, Long Beach. Produced in association with AftermathSurvivingPsychopathy.org. Your host has been Dr. Robert Shug. Your producers have been Brian Frederick, Chantel Fahmy, and Gurjeet Brar. Join us next Monday at 4 p.m. for another exciting episode. If you or someone you know has been victimized and you'd like to talk to someone, call the Cal State Long Beach Counseling and Psychological Services number at 562-985-4001.